Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Wednesday, October 15th, and I'm Nat Cardos reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, welfare check at Pumpkin Patch in Mad River ends in arrest for public intoxication and child endangerment charges. Local tribes committed to saving critical microgrid project that is up for termination by U.S. Department of Energy. And Humboldt County Sheriff's Office Major Crimes Division seeking public's assistance in searching for John Vang after 2-year anniversary of disappearance. So stay tuned. Those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilcut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection these tribes have to this region.
Saturday, October 11th, at approximately 5:04 p.m., Humboldt County Sheriff's deputies responded to a welfare check in Mad River after reports were made of a woman walking in the road with two small children. KMUD News spoke to Aaron Inske, Public Information Officer with the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office, for more information on the incident.
So on October 11th, 2025, at approximately 5:04 p.m., Humboldt County Sheriff's deputies responded to a welfare check in the 800 block of Mad River Road in Arcata, following reports of an intoxicated female walking in the road with two small children. Deputies arrived on scene and located the woman, who was later identified as 38-year-old Mary Elizabeth Miller, along with three children. During their investigation, deputies learned that Miller and her children had gone to a local pumpkin patch, where witnesses reported she was drinking alcoholic beverages while at the event. Upon leaving the event on foot, she was observed falling down several times while holding on to one of the children. One of the children had visible injuries that did not require immediate medical attention. Deputies contacted Child Welfare Services. Following their contact with the children's father, the children were safely released into his custody. Based on their investigation and witness statements, deputies arrested Miller and transported her to the Humboldt County Correctional Facility, where she was booked on the following charges: PC 273D, subsection A, child abuse, infliction of corporal punishment or injury; PC 273A, subsection A, child endangerment; and PC 647F, public intoxication.
Anyone with information on the case or related criminal activity is encouraged to call the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office at 707-445-7251 or the Sheriff's Office Crime Tip Line at 707-268-2539. On October 2nd, the United States Department of Energy, DOE, announced the termination of 321 financial awards that support 223 projects nationwide. According to the DOE website, they state, quote, "Following a thorough, individualized financial review, DOE determined that these projects did not adequately advance the nation's energy needs, were not economically viable, and would not provide a positive return on investment of taxpayer dollars," end quote. One of these rescinded awards is the Tribal Energy Resilience and Sovereignty, TERRAS, project, which is a regional initiative led by the Blue Lake Rancheria Tribe, Hoopa Valley Tribe, and Yurok Tribe in partnership with the Redwood Coast Energy Authority, RCEA, as applicant, the Schatz Energy Research Center, that served as project design and development lead, and PG&E. KMUD News spoke to Linnea Jackson, a member of the Hoopa Valley Tribe and general manager for the tribe's utility, for more information on what the TERRAS project does.
The TERRAS project, which stands for Tribal Energy Resilience and Sovereignty, is a collaborative project with the applicant of Redwood Coast Energy Authority, partnered with our technical staff at Schatz Energy Research Center, and it started off as a four-tribe partnership between Blue Lake, Hoopa, Yurok, and the Kurok Tribe. It provides, three of those tribes are both located off the Hoopa 1101 circuit, which is operated and managed by Pacific Gas and Electric. The Hoopa 1101 circuit is in their 1% of their top worst performing circuits in their service territory. So there's a lot of resiliency issues, power outages that our communities face on an annual basis. So it's a collaborative project that bridges technical innovation, policy and regulatory, and tribal government, CCA, and higher education partnerships to develop nested microgrids within our region.
In January of this year, RCEA entered into a conditional agreement with DOE's Grid Resilience Innovations Grant Program for $87.6 million to support the Terrace Project. It was intended to be used to build a network of tribally owned and operated community microgrids that would be able to address the issues of persistent power reliability issues that communities across Northern California in rural areas face. As of recording, DOE still has yet to contact RCEA or any tribes affiliated with the project as to why the Terrace Project specifically was terminated. KMA News spoke with Eileen Verbeck, Deputy Executive Director for RCEA, about her initial reaction to the news.
We're very disappointed. I will say we have not officially been notified by the Department of Energy that the project's been terminated. So, you know, we're still hopeful that they will deem this project that, you know, within the administration's current goal for local energy production. But in the case that they do terminate based on the list that came out, you know, the group has put a lot of time and energy into this, and so it is very disheartening. However, it really hasn't reduced the enthusiasm of seeing this project come to fruition. And so, you know, we're looking as a group to do more of a phased approach. So using the funds in hand to have the tribes continue to build out these projects and lay the groundwork and then allow for future funding down the road to build it out to the same capacity that we were hoping to build using the Department of Energy funds.
A microgrid is a localized independent energy network that can generate its own power from different sources, in this case generators, and be able to store it for later use. This would help support tribal and rural communities in the event of outages or public safety power shutoffs, PSPS. More often than not, many tribal and rural communities in Humboldt have to deal with prolonged power outages that not only disrupt day-to-day activities, but threaten vital services like tribal police and fire districts. Jackson expands more on how these microgrids help HUPA specifically.
So HUPA Public Utilities, which is our chartered tribal entity, facilitates critical infrastructure, domestic water irrigation, broadband, solid waste management. All of those activities require energy resiliency. We have 2 treatment plants, 20 storage tanks, booster stations, and that's just the water side. So once power is impacted, we lose the ability to produce safe drinking water. It cuts off power at times to critical communications that we rely on for our tribal police and our fire districts, obviously internet, and that requires us to have backup generators for almost every piece of infrastructure that we have. Sometimes there's faults on those generators, and if the power is out, the generator is non-op, we go down with critical infrastructure coming from life-saving water, communications, and other basic needs. We have tribal elder population that rely on medical devices or having their medicines that maybe need to be refrigerated, loss of food. So there's a large impact to our community that happens, and we have to address multiple times throughout the year.
The Terrace Project is designed to support more than 140 miles of power lines on the HUPA 1101 circuit, which is known for experiencing some of the most frequent and longest duration power outages in the state. These outages affect communities along the Trinity and Klamath Rivers, including HUPA, Wichipec, and Orleans, which include essential government services for the HUPA Valley, Yurok, and Karuk tribes. Tribal nations already pay 56% higher electricity prices than the U.S. average and experience 6.5 times more outages.
The risk is that we still struggle as a region. It's not just the tribal regions. It's the rural, remote areas of Humboldt County that experience anywhere from 7 to 10 times the number of outages within PG&E service territory. Again, there's health implications, there's safety implications, there's critical infrastructure that goes down, and there's a loss of resiliency and community upgrades. Even the upriver Yurok, you know, just received power within, you know, the 2000s. And so we're struggling here as a region from a resiliency standpoint. We have remained unified as a collaborative team and will seek other funding, but it definitely is a setback with timeframes because the build-out, testing and commission, procurement, all of that process itself was a 5-year project. So we're kind of at the starting blocks again of securing the bulk of the funding, and then we would have another 5 to 6 year build-out. So it is a setback, but we are not going to give up fighting for what this community needs.
The alternative to this project would be undergrounding lines along the HOOPA 1101 circuit, but that would cost approximately $1 billion, as opposed to the only $200 million that the terrace project costs. Here's Verbeck with more.
You know, to tie it specific to Humboldt County, you know, I think you may remember when we were having the PSPS events and we were losing power for long durations here in the kind of Bay Area of Humboldt County. And then the technology, they were able to island, you know, most of the city centers of Humboldt County. And so we, you know, I think for the most part, most people in Humboldt aren't experiencing those common frequent outages that we once were. But that isn't the case for Eastern Humboldt. They're not part of the islanding. So, you know, I think we don't realize here on the coast how often, due to events maybe very far from us, that the grid is going down. And then, you know, in these rural areas, that's how, you know, they're also further from getting to grocery stores. And when your refrigerator and your freezer goes out, you know, you're really impacted. It's just that much more difficult to kind of maintain that, what we take for granted, of having reliable electricity. So, you know, these projects are very creative and they're community-led, which is important. This is something that, you know, each community that it's in will own it and operate it. And then, oh, and it's more affordable. So the other solution to this would be undergrounding the lines along this circuit. And, you know, a rough estimate I've heard to do that is roughly $1 billion. The project as originally designed was $200 million. So I know that seems like a lot, but the other solution is a lot more expensive and it may be easier to replicate for other communities in the future.
If the project ends up being terminated and loses the $200 million of federal funding, which is the bulk, they will need to start looking elsewhere. Stated in a press release from the RCEA, quote, philanthropic and purpose-driven partners now have a unique opportunity to help advance first-of-its-kind scalable model for community-owned microgrids that can be replicated in other regions facing climate and infrastructure challenges, end quote. Here's Jackson with more on how the Terrace team is working with this new challenge.
The Terrace project as a whole has multiple portfolios, so I listed all of our project partners, and we're each independently bringing additional funding to the table. So we are working with the California Energy Commission. We, the HOOPA and the Yurok Tribe, are also current awardees, which we're negotiating through PG&E's Community Microgrid Incentive Program. The delay in the project also stalled our ability to help secure the tax credits that we were relying on. There's some philanthropic dollars as a bridge loan that was also secured. So each project partner is bringing to the table non-federal match because the DOE portion of that grant required the one-to-one match. So there's portions of the project that are still occurring and then will be facilitated on each of the tribal lands, but the DOE portion was a bulk of the funding to be able to provide resiliency in much-needed areas.
Plans are still set for the Terrace project to continue in some shape or form, though progress may be considerably slower due to the lack of funding. For more information about the project, the website is shatscenter.org/2024/08/TERAS/. John Star Vang, 36, was last seen in August of 2023. He was believed to be working on a marijuana grow at a rural property in either the Panther Gap area or Honeydew in southern Humboldt during the time of his disappearance. With the two-year anniversary of his disappearance having passed, the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office is seeking the public's assistance in locating him. KMA News spoke to Aaron Inskip, Humboldt County Sheriff's Office Public Information Officer, for more information.
The Humboldt County Sheriff's Office Major Crimes Division is seeking the public's assistance as part of an ongoing investigation involving a missing person last known to be in the southern Humboldt area in August of 2023. With the two-year anniversary of John's disappearance upon us, investigators are asking anyone who may have seen or had contact with John Star Vang, age 36, around August of 2023 to come forward. John is described as a Hmong male adult, approximately 5'2" tall, 165 pounds, with black hair and brown eyes. He was reported missing by his family and loved ones in March of 2024 and was believed to be working on a marijuana grow on a rural property in the Panther Gap area near Honeydew in southern Humboldt area during the time of his disappearance. As part of this effort, the Sheriff's Office is also attempting to identify three Hmong females who were seen in the company of John at Walmart in Eureka on August 14th, 2023. The Humboldt County Sheriff's Office is also attempting to locate a Hispanic male known only as Mateo, who used to work with John on the same marijuana farm. These individuals may have important information that could assist in the investigation.
HCSO is urging anyone who may have interacted with Vang during the summer of 2023 or may have knowledge of individuals residing or working in the Panther Gap area of Southern Humboldt during that time is encouraged to contact Investigator Booner with the HCSO Major Crimes Division at 707-445-7251 and reference case 202-401-065. In state news, leaders across California support offshore wind. Despite Trump opposition, Public News Service's Suzanne Potter reports.
Elected officials, labor unions, and grassroots groups recently gathered in San Luis Obispo to show their support for offshore wind energy, even though the Trump administration has moved to reevaluate offshore wind leases and has pulled hundreds of millions in federal funding. California voters approved a climate bond that will upgrade port infrastructure in Morro Bay and Humboldt to be ready to accept energy from offshore wind turbines in the future. Mark Simonin with the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Local 639 says floating offshore wind carries a lot of economic potential.
There will be operation and maintenance. There will be small manufacturing, warehousing. There's going to be multiple jobs through multiple sectors. So it will be a real positive impact for the working class folks.
But the Trump administration has focused its efforts on boosting the oil and gas industry and has reversed many Biden-era renewable energy programs. More than 250 elected officials across California have signed a letter supporting the responsible build-out of offshore wind in order to help the state reach its goal of transitioning to 100% renewable energy and become carbon neutral by 2045. Susan Callery is a former Poway City Council member and the retired manager of NASA's now-defunct climate website.
I have two grandkids, and every time I look at them, I just wonder what kind of world they're going to grow up in. I'm very worried about the consequences of climate change, especially since CO2 emissions keep growing every year.
Last year, the California Energy Commission approved plans to develop 25 gigawatts of floating offshore wind power, granting five ocean leases off the coast of Humboldt and Morro Bay. Experts at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory estimate California has 200 gigawatts of offshore wind potential, enough to power 25 million homes. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
In national news, hope and fear in Gaza as hostages, prisoners released on day four of ceasefire, but Israel limits aid into Gaza. KPFA's Christopher Martinez reports.
Hamas has released hostages. Israel has released Palestinian detainees. And much of the world is celebrating the ceasefire in Gaza. But 4 days in, some obstacles are appearing as questions swirl over what happens in the longer term or even the near future. Among the big questions, when or whether Hamas will lay down its arms. President Donald Trump weighed in Tuesday.
Well, they're going to disarm, and because they said they were going to disarm. And if they don't disarm, we will disarm them.
How will you do that?
I don't have to explain that to you. But if they don't disarm, we will disarm them. They know I'm not playing games.
Just days earlier, Trump had hailed the ceasefire agreement, speaking at a Middle East peace summit in Egypt last weekend.
After years of suffering and bloodshed, the war in Gaza is over. Humanitarian aid is now pouring in, including hundreds of truckloads of food, medical equipment, and other supplies, much of it paid for by people in this room.
United Nations Chief Antonio Guterres has also praised the ceasefire, urging parties to build on the momentum and, in his words, end the nightmare in Gaza. While the UN has ramped up aid deliveries into Gaza since the ceasefire began, Israel has now announced it's cutting in half the aid it's allowing in. Israel is accusing Hamas of violating the ceasefire with the slow release of dead hostages. The issue emerged a day after jubilation over the return of the last 20 living hostages and the release of hundreds of Palestinian prisoners in exchange. Hamas and the Red Cross have said that recovering the remains of dead hostages is a challenge because of Gaza's destruction, and Hamas told mediators of the deal that some are in areas controlled by Israeli troops. Aid agencies say Israel's new restrictions on aid amount to far less than what the population of Gaza needs. The UN Development Program says destruction across Gaza is in the region of 84%, and in Gaza City, it's up to 92%. A recent assessment by the United Nations, the European Union, and the World Bank says $70 billion will be needed to rebuild. As for the shorter term, aid workers are calling for the opening of all crossing points into Gaza. Tess Ingram of the United Nations Children's Fund, or UNICEF, described a Palestinian family returning home, but worrying about whether a water truck will return and how to get needed medicine.
This is emblematic of the situation for so many families returning to complete destruction in Gaza City and other parts of the Gaza Strip. And it's why the humanitarian response is so important. Families need absolutely everything right now. We need the hundreds of trucks a day that were promised to get into the Gaza Strip and to reach the families who so desperately need it.
Up to now, the ceasefire has been just the first phase in the peace agreement. As for the future, people in the region are watching with a combination of hope and skepticism. Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
And in National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The remnants of Typhoon Halong over the weekend have left at least one woman dead and more than 1,000 people displaced in western Alaska. The disaster happened right before the start of the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention and the Elders and Youth Conference. The Alaska Desk's Ayolna Nidem reports that the storm is shaping the tone of this year's events.
The Alaska Federation of Natives Convention always focuses on issues most pertinent to local indigenous communities. And this year, a catastrophic storm that battered predominantly Alaska Native villages is already the center of the conversations. Senator Lisa Murkowski spoke at the beginning of the Elders and Youth Conference, the traditional prologue to the main AFN event.
As we gather for this sharing and this collective convening, let us keep in mind those that are in harm's way and those who are out there to be with them and to help them.
Communities and rescue groups are still looking for missing people and assessing the damage from the storm. Meanwhile, AFN and other local Indigenous organizations are looking for ways to help. AFN is one of 12 mostly Indigenous organizations that formed the Western Alaska Disaster Relief Fund to provide assistance to villages. On Thursday, AFN plans to hold a blanket dance fundraiser for the disaster. Roy Glowin is the president of the First Alaskans Institute that hosts the Elders and Youth Conference. On Sunday, he spoke about the destruction from the storm.
It's easy to feel distant, but I ask you to lean in, because while the storm may be hundreds of miles away, the people affected are our neighbors, our friends, and our family.
Marilyn Atley is a healer from the interior who participated in the Elders and Youth Conference. She invited attendees, especially young people, to talk about what they feel and consider visiting a healing station.
You have to make up your own mind to be resilient. Any type of loss that you're going to go through in your life, any type of happening, problem, you have to make up your own mind to overcome it.
The Elders and Youth Conference is running at the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage through Wednesday. AFN is scheduled there from Thursday to Saturday. With reporting help from Rhonda McBride in Anchorage, I am Alona Naiden.
Meanwhile, community groups and businesses across the state are coordinating storm relief efforts for the devastated communities. The Alaska Community Foundation has partnered with local and regional organizations to create the Western Alaska Disaster Relief Fund. The foundation's Ashley Ellingson says they're distributing the funds to communities hit hardest.
It's geared towards immediate support and then long-term resilience. And the thing that's unique about this fund is that we have partnered with local and regional organizations to make sure that the money goes to those to the areas that it's needed most.
The fund is a partnership with the Alaska Federation of Natives, the Association of Village Council Presidents, the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, and a number of other groups serving Alaskans in the region. As of Tuesday afternoon, the fund had raised more than $300,000 from donors. Jenny Ragland, chair of Alaska Voluntary Organizations Active in Disaster, says cash donations are a better option than goods, since storing and transporting items can present challenges of their own.
While it may seem impersonal, cash really is the best opportunity to help meet those immediate needs that are coming our way. It provides flexibility for us to purchase exactly what's needed to procure those items quickly and to get them into the hands of disaster survivors.
More information about the effort is online at alaskacf.org. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Larry Lashley, and thanks to our reporters, Suzanne Potter, Christopher Martinez, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMA News is online, and you can find us on KMA.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commute. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@KMA.org. Are you passionate about your community, looking to report what's happening around Mendocino? KMA News is looking for stringer reporters from the Mendocino area to cover local Mendocino stories that matter. Whether you're a seasoned journalist or just eager to learn, we'll help you get started. You'll get training, support, and a chance to amplify real voices from your community. If you're interested, email news@KMUD for more information. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Matt Cardos.